Everyone, welcome to part two of what I'm calling a field guide to the Bodhisattvas. For those of you who weren't here last week, or who may be completely new to the word Bodhisattva, Bodhi means awakened or awakening, and Sattva means being, and a Bodhisattva is a being in Mahayana Buddhism who vows to live in this world, serving all beings, helping all beings to awaken and to sort of set aside personal goals for enlightenment while practicing continuously to awaken. And in early Buddhism, the word bodhisattva referred to the Buddha in his previous lives before he became the Buddha. Countless lives as a bodhisattva. But as Mahayana Buddhism developed in the several centuries after the Buddha's death, images of bodhisattvas were created. I think of it almost really as an artistic endeavor out of the human artistic impulse to express visually, in this case, the qualities that a bodhisattva embodies. They're not deities, although in Buddhist cultures they can be worshipped in the way that a deity is in many cases. They're not deities, they're not based on historical figures. They are essences. They're, if you want to use the language of Jungian psychology, archetypes. So last week we talked about Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. I'm gonna cover the four sort of most prominent bodhisattvas to begin with, and then I might add some on at the end. Tonight, I'm going to talk about Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. Also, one thing I said last week, when you first encounter these names, they all sound kind of alike, and when you see the images, they all look pretty similar, and that's why I decided to call it a field guide to the bodhisattvas, because just like it's really hard to tell sparrows, different species of sparrows apart, or really hard to tell different species of seagulls apart. But once you know what to look for, just the same with bodhisattvas, once you know what to look for, you start to be able to recognize them. Not only in the statuary and the art, but in each other and in yourself and all around you, which is even more important. So did anybody notice any manifestations of Manjushri, the wisdom of Bodhisattva of wisdom this past week? I'm talking to the people who were here last week. Because that's what I really want you to look for. You know, and again this week. I think you'll get more attuned to what to look for as we go along. Chances are, as you go about your daily life, you do encounter Samantabhadra Bodhisattva. He is the Bodhisattva of great activity, or shining practice, sometimes it's called. So we value activity in our society. So he's a good bodhisattva for our day and age. How do we guide that activity? In paintings and sculpture, as you see up here, he's often paired with Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, as attendants to the Buddha. So with Manjushri seated on a lion, as we noticed last week, on the Buddha's left, not ours, and then Samantabhadra gets to ride on an elephant on the Buddha's right. Remember how those who were here last week, we talked about how Manjushri has the gift of language. He's eloquent, and he's insightful, and he's full of wisdom, and he gets a little carried away sometimes. And so there's an old Zen saying that says, when Manjushri falls down drunk, Samantabhadra cares for him. Because maybe once in a while Manjushri gets a little intoxicated with the brilliance of his own dharma, or his own exposition of the dharma. But Samantabhadra is ever practical, but also visionary. He's an interesting combination. So he helps to keep Manjushri in balance. So that's there they are, one on either side of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni. So you start to see how these bodhisattvas function in us and in the world. Samantabhadra's name is translated into English as universal virtue or universal goodness. In Chinese, it's Puxian, and in Japanese, Fugen. Most of the time, I'll refer to Samantabhadra as he, because he is traditionally portrayed as male, though often with that sort of serenely androgynous quality common in much of Buddhist sculpture. So please keep in mind that these bodhisattva archetypes are aspects of every one of us, of each one of us, regardless of gender. And as I mentioned, Samantabhadra is typically depicted there's another image of the two bodhisattvas, one on either side of the Buddha. Manjushri gets to ride on a beautiful blue lion in this image. And typically next, Samantabhadra is depicted on a white elephant. You may recall that when the Buddha's mother, the historical Buddha's mother, was pregnant with him, that a white elephant appeared and touched her belly with his trunk, its trunk. In ancient Indian culture, the elephant was a symbol of dignity, strength, royalty. In the sutra on the contemplation of Samantabhadra, which comes at the very end of the Lotus Sutra, the elephant is elaborately described as having six tusks and seven legs. It hovers 7 feet off the ground, and yet with each slow, majestic step, a dharma wheel appears in its footprint, from which springs a lotus flower, upon which another elephant appears, which becomes part of the great elephant's retinue. So you can see there's smaller elephants around the periphery of the base of that image. Samantabhadra is typically depicted wearing flowing robes and jeweled ornaments of Indian nobility, and with his hair in a headdress or a topknot. Often he has his hands in gassho, as you see here, or sometimes he holds a lotus or a wish-fulfilling jewel, the Dharma jewel, or a sutra scroll, or a teaching staff. So that's where he can sometimes look a little bit like Manjushri, who also is dressed in that same way. A more unusual representation of him shows him with 20 arms and hands, holding the various implements that he uses skillfully to meet the needs of many beings. So again, you can see the little elephants around the base on that image. Yes. The sutra where Samantabhadra features most prominently is called the Avatamsaka Sutra, or Flower Ornament Sutra, or in Chinese, the Huayan Sutra, Kegon in Japanese. It's a remarkable piece of literature. It's about that thick with small page, thin pages in small print. It's very dense. And it's esteemed throughout the Mahayana Buddhist world. It's a long, elaborate compendium of bodhisattva practices. And it's just, and Mantabhadra is kind of the star performer. The sutra is packed with sets of 10. 10 practices, 10 stages, 10 concentrations, 10 dedications, 10 super knowledges, 10 acceptances, and more along the bodhisattva path. But I thought we'd look at a few of the characteristics. We mentioned the paramitas last week that are associated with Samantabhadra. Vows, meditative concentration, knowledge, spiritual power, skillful means are all associated with him. But particularly he's known for the depth and breadth of his vows. And so of course he has 10 vows. So these are the 10 vows of Samantabhadra. Each one is not only a vow, but a practice. The first three are venerating Buddhas, praising Buddhas, and making offerings to Buddhas. Now, to many Westerners, these seem like devotional practices, you know, sort of worshiping, and that's not really what we showed up to do. You know, we want to learn how to meditate. But there are perspectives on these practices that can help us feel more kinship with them. Because when we bow to an image of Buddha, or to each other, or to an ancient red cedar, we are bowing to our Buddha nature reflected back to us from everything around us in many forms. In the we don't have this in our chant book, but in the complete Soto Zen chant book, there's a verse I really love, and it goes, "The one who bows and the one bowed to are boundless and still. My body and the other's body are in essence not two. May I attain liberation together with all beings, raising up the highest aspiration, relying on the ultimate truth." The one who bows and the one bowed to are boundless and still. So I use that sometimes myself. I like that feeling of that a lot. So we could say similarly with praising Buddhas, that praising is acknowledging the qualities of wisdom and compassion, the paramitas, that the images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas express. And this praising kind of enlivens and nourishes the seeds of those qualities in ourselves. You know, praising's a little, you know, old-fashioned. It's not kind of cool, so we don't go around praising so much in our culture, do we? We associate that with different cultures from our own, but maybe we could learn a little from them. The early African cultures used to write beautiful praise songs, praise poems, you know, praising the elephant, praising the cheetah, you know, praising the grizzly bear. We could praise the grizzly bear. And when we do that, we enliven something in ourselves. And then making offerings. When we make offerings to Buddhas, that doesn't just mean offering financial support at the zendo, although that helps pay the rent, but it means making an offering of every aspect of our practice, offering up even the toughest parts of our practice, offering up our mistakes, our blunders, our ignorance, our self-clinging, making an offering of our self-clinging. Each time we make an offering, it helps us let go, even a little, of our entrenched habit patterns. So those are the first three vows. The fourth vow is the practice of beginning anew, or sometimes that's called confession. Acknowledging our actions, that have harmed ourselves or others, seeing deeply into the causes and conditions that led to those actions, the obstacles and delusions, and then renewing our intention to act and speak mindfully to be of benefit. So beginning anew. And then the fifth vow is to practice rejoicing in the happiness and freedom of others. This is the Brahma Vihara, or the heavenly abode of sympathetic joy, mudita. And that's not an easy vow, is it? You know, we can easily slip into envy when someone else is doing well, or jealousy. How can we be really glad about other people's well-being? Even people we don't like that much. How can we be glad about their well-being? And that doesn't mean we have to be glad about something that they're doing that's not so healthy that they want, but their true well-being, their true well-being. But this is another vow that's really crucial to our bodhisattva practice and really relevant in our times. So, sixth vow is to request Buddhas to teach. Even the Buddha himself, after his enlightenment experience, was hesitant to begin teaching. How much more so those of us who are just apprentice bodhisattvas, right? We need to encourage each other to share the Dharma authentically. Not in a pompous or show-off kind of way, but from deep humility and just the authenticity of our own humanity. And trusting that we are supported by Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Seventh vow, not to enter nirvana, to stay in this world serving other beings. And the eighth, ninth, and tenth vows are to study the Dharma, to benefit others, and to transfer or dedicate the merit of one's practice to the liberation of all beings. So, Samantabhadra helps us get our priorities straight. 10 vows. It's enough to keep us pretty on track, I think. So the paramitas, or qualities of knowledge and spiritual power, give Samantabhadra the ability to use the paramita of skillful means. This is his really special one, skillful means or compassionate means, to teach and support beings in infinitely varied ways. Samantabhadra is both eminently mundane and practical. You know, so he's with all his, is that the one that shows his 20 hands, each one with a different tool, right?
There's one more that looks like a knee.
Go ahead. Yeah, there's another one. He looks a little bit like the thousand-armed Kuan Yin here, also with a tool in each hand. So very, very practical, but also Samantabhadra is visionary. He has a very strong meditative concentration or samadhi, and he sees deeply the true nature of reality with visions of the vast interconnected cosmos. So the Avatamsaka Sutra is the place that gives us that wonderful sort of holographic image that you may have heard of Indra's net to describe the universe, where the universe is infinitely connected and in a net-like four-dimensional web of connection, with each node of intersection having a jewel that reflects all others. That's the image. And it's pretty amazing that image, you know, was articulated so long ago. It's an ecological vision that resonates now with cutting-edge physics. and science of the mind, the brain, and neuroscience. So in the Tibetan tradition, in the Vajrayana tradition, Samantabhadra is associated with Vairochana, who's the cosmic Buddha. And we see images of Vairochana. They're often, he's often surrounded with also many, many other little Buddhas. Right. But images of Samantabhadra are actually much less common if you're just visiting temples in Japan, which we've done a lot. You really don't see images of Samantabhadra very often compared to Manjushri or Avalokiteshvara. And that's because he has this vast cosmic nature that is ultimately indescribable. And it's said that only those who have undergone long years, even lifetimes of spiritual practice, can receive visions of Samantabhadra. And yet, he's at work all around us, often in disguise, working in humble forms, you know, like a carpenter, or you remember the story last week of Manjushri appearing at a temple feast as a pregnant beggar woman and being turned away and then being revealed as Manjushri. So there's a Japanese no play. Now, do you know what, have you heard of Japanese no theater? Some have, some haven't. It dates back to the 14th century. It's very formal, very slow. There's a chorus that chants, and then there's some percussion instruments, and it's masked. Some of those performers are masked. These very slow, stately dances. It's quite different, also quite magical, especially if it's outdoors at night by torchlight. And a number, many of the plays have Buddhist themes. So there's one called Eguchi, in which Samantabhadra, or in Japanese, Fugen, appears in the form of a courtesan or a upscale prostitute, we could say. She seems to have been one of some education and high rank because she was an accomplished poet. And she was known as the Lady of Eguchi, named after the town, a port town, along a river in what's now Osaka, the Yodogawa, where she lived. And in the day, rich patrons would ride in riverboats with the courtesans. They're like flatboats, and the courtesans would sing and dance to entertain the patrons on the river. And as with many no plays, it's a ghost story. So in the story, in the play, a traveling monk arrives in Eguchi, and I don't know if we can turn that fan off. He has heard a legend of how long ago the renowned monk and poet Saigyo had come to the courtesan's door asking for a night's lodging. And when she turned him away, he recited a poem, sort of scolding her. And she countered with a poem in reply, after which she invited him in, and they had a long night's conversation and became friends. So the traveling monk visits her grave. He knew the story, and he recited Saigyo's poem, which goes, "To scorn the world and all its ways, that is hard. But you, the least moment's refuge, you cling to as your own." So he's kind of scolding her for turning him away. And this least this moment's refuge in Japanese is kari no yado, which means a temporary lodging. But it, in Buddhist terms, the temporary lodging is right, our body, us, our life is the temporary lodging. So there's a double meaning there of you begrudge me a night's lodging and you're clinging to your life. So after he recites this poem, a village woman appears and explains to him that the Lady of Iguchi had not wanted to put Saigyo in a compromising position as a monk by inviting him in. And then she recites the poem that the courtesan had composed in reply to Saigyo, which goes, "You are one, I hear, that scorns who scorns the world. And my sole concern is to say, do not set your heart upon a moment's refuge." So she's right back to him. She says, "I'm just, you know," she's telling him, "I'm just looking after you. Don't you be so set on a temporary refuge, temporary lodging." And then she suggests to the monk that he come back in the evening and offer prayers at the grave for the Lady Iguchi, and then reveals that she is the ghost of the Lady Iguchi and vanishes. First act. Next, the monk meets a man from the village and asks him, "Well, tell me more about this Lady of Iguchi." And the man tells him another legend about another monk, Shoku, who is a devotee of Samantabhadra, Fugen Bosatsu. And this monk, Shoku, had a dream of the courtesan and her attendants coming on a boat on the river, dancing and singing. And in the dream, the boat transforms into a white elephant and the courtesan into Samantabhadra. But the description is that when he closes, this is supposed to be a dream, but when he closes his eyes, he sees the bodhisattva, and he opens his eyes, he sees the boat and the courtesan. Closes his eyes, elephant and bodhisattva. Opens his eyes, courtesan. So it's like relative and absolute, relative and absolute. Right? This world of samsara, that world of boundlessness. Open, closed. That was sort of an interlude. Next act. The monk goes back to the grave under the full moon. Of course, there's a full moon. And suddenly he sees the boat coming down the river carrying the Lady of Iguchi with two of her fellow courtesans singing a song telling of the Buddha's teaching of impermanence. We set our hearts on one moment's refuge, a temporary lodging. If we did not, the world would not be such a sad place. Blossoms, autumn leaves, the moon, falling snow. Yes, all things are but a moment's refuge. Never set your heart upon them. That was my warning to the monk Saigyo. I will leave you now, revealed as the Bodhisattva Fugen, all-wise. So then, she's transformed into a great white elephant, and the Lady of Iguchi into Fugen Bosatsu. But in this painting, she appears as herself on the elephant, in the guy, you know, of a, and there's the monk down to the left, looking up at her. Great elephant. Look at him. So, the final chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra It's a beautiful, long, kind of epic story, translated as Entry into the Realm of Reality. It's a tale of the pilgrimage of a young boy named Sudana. And on his journey, he meets 53 teachers. He starts with Manjushri, Bodhisattva of Wisdom, who sort of sets him on his path. And the final teacher he meets is Samantabhadra. And the teachers and spiritual friends he meets are young and old, male and female, rich and poor, from all walks of life, from scholars and holy men and women to prostitutes, and even an executioner is one of them. So in a sense, these are all manifestations of Samantabhadra. Each one, none claims to hold the whole truth, or to bind him to any particular doctrine, or to him or herself. But each one guides him further on his way. And each one gives him a unique Dharma gift. The Korean poet, who was once a monk himself, Ko Un, wrote a beautiful novelized version of this chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra called Little Pilgrim. And it's interspersed with poems and songs. It's quite lovely. And when Sudana meets Samantabhadra, Samantabhadra appears as a wise old man who greets him very warmly and kindly. And then Sudana has a kind of visionary experience, seeing Samantabhadra with Buddhas emanating from every pore of his body. The description, this is in the Avatamsaka Sutra, the description is quite florid and detailed, a little bit hallucinogenic. But the passage in Ko Un's novel is more economical and poetic. I just want to read you Samantabhadra's last words to Sudana. You are equal now to the Buddha and all the bodhisattvas. Henceforth, the people you encounter will not be Buddhas and bodhisattvas or any kind of teacher. They will each and every one of them be a living creature that you will have to meet with wisdom and compassion. So he's saying now, you're on the path, you're fully on the bodhisattva path, and it is now your job to help me meet each individual in the way that's just right for them. Samantabhadra doesn't appear in the Zen koan literature, unlike Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. But there is one koan that quotes the Avatamsaka Sutra. And it's just a short quote. And it's this: there is not a single sentient being who does not fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. It is only because of false conceptions and attachments they do not realize it. And so that's us, right? Not a single one that does not possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. It's kind of a central question, isn't it? How is it that we each have that full potential for the luminous mind and compassionate heart of a Buddha, and yet we're obstructed from that reality by our greed, hatred, ignorance, our habit patterns? It's Samantabhadra's bodhisattva job to use every means at his disposal to help us awaken to our true nature, and to appear in unexpected forms, right? To jolt us out of our stereotypes, like the Lady of Eguchi did with the poet monk Sagyo, right? So keep an eye out. You might recognize him or her, so that you will recognize him or her when you meet them. It might even be a bicycle bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. This is the Japanese-American artist Mayumi Oda's version of Samantabhadra. Can you guys see that from there? Yeah. Turn it a little bit. So her bodhisattvas are quite delightful.
What is that in the basket?
That's the elephant. That's the little elephant riding in the basket like a poodle. No, that's the elephant.
Okay, now?
Yeah. Is there any significance to the cabbage?
Can I see the... Other than garden scenes and vegetables appear a lot in her art. Probably because she was involved. Well, she lived at Green Gulch, which is the San Francisco Zen Center's farm. But also now she has a center in Hawaii, I believe, where they're doing sustainable agriculture. It's a really important part of her life, so cabbages do crop up. Okay, so I will pause now, as usual, and ask you to get into small groups. And I'm going to turn this off.